On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
My name is Margarita Miranda, and I'm making Chilean empanadas.
What is an empanada?
An empanada is the, I guess, the Chilean version of a meat turnover, and they are sizzling right now, so I have to pay attention to make sure they don't burn.
There's always that dish, the one your mom made as you stood by her side as she warned you about the hot stove. For Carolina Miranda, it was empanadas.
We would accompany her in the kitchen as she made them when we were kids. She'd give us a little piece of dough to play with, and, you know, we'd try to stuff it, and we'd try to roll it out. And usually by the time we were done, it was black because we dropped it on the floor and, you know, thrown it at each other, and sometimes half our filling would fall out. So it was this process that, honestly, we just grew. I don't remember a time in which my mother didn't make empanadas like we grew up with her making them, always like this special occasion dish. You knew something was going to be a special occasion when she was making empanadas.
Carolina moved around a lot when she was a kid, so for her, home was in the kitchen, where her mom's empanadas were. Now she calls Los Angeles home. She's a journalist with the LA Times, and she recently wrote a piece for Lucky Peach about her mom's signature dish. We're lucky to have both mother and daughter in the studio this morning. Good morning, Margarita.
Good morning, Evan.
Carolina.
Good morning.
So, Carolina, in this article that you wrote for Lucky Peach's We Heart Mom series, you talked about where you grew up, and I was just fascinated by that.
Well, we grew up all over the place. Southern California was the base, but because my father was a heavy construction engineer, it meant that we lived in the Middle East, we lived in Africa, we'd spend long stints in South America, we'd come back to California, we'd be in the Valley, we'd be in Orange County, we were all over the place. And so, you know, one of the constants in all of that was my mother's cooking, and definitely her empanadas.
I'm wondering if there was a particular experience that was one of the cities in which you were living that was so foreign, so far flung from anything familiar, and the empanada eating experience so nurturing and so deeply of home that you can think of.
I mean, I think I probably recollect the most from South Africa. South African cuisine is fairly simple. Cuisine, you have cornmeal mushes and a lot of barbecued
sausages
and sausages, and that's that sort of thing. And I remember a couple of parties where my mom made them, and it, first of all, I think it was like a revelation for most of the house guests there, but also in this environment that was so different from every other place that we had lived in, and from Southern California and from South America, where my parents are from. It was just, it didn't matter where you were. Like, they always tasted the same. They always had this incredible texture and flavor. And usually where there's a plate of my mom's empanadas, there's a bunch of people going nuts around them.
So let's talk about your version. Are they fried or baked?
Fried.
What is the stuffing called?
Pino.
Okay, so what is pino?
That is a Chilean word, because the word pino means pine. But it's a mixture of onions and beef and garlic and all kinds of spices. And it's cooked for a long time and juicy.
And when you say juicy, what do you mean by that?
The onions, because I put about the same amount of onions as beef, give it a lot of juice. So you have to thicken it and refrigerated overnight so that you can stuff the empanadas. Otherwise, it would be impossible.
Because when you refrigerate it overnight, all that juiciness combines with the fat of the meat and it kind of solidifies.
Exactly. And I put a little bit of thickening agent. You can use any thickening agent, but just a small amount because you want it to melt when you fry them.
Mm. So who taught you how to make your recipe, Margarita?
I learned from looking at one of my aunt's housekeeper. She used to make them, but she used to make them in large quantities, and she had been making it all her life, and she didn't measure anything. So I had to, like, adjust things, start, you know, by trial and error, get to the point where I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, but sometimes I think that's the best way to learn, because what you're learning is what everything looks like and what it feels like, which especially for dough is really important.
Yes, it is. It is.
It's so interesting because it's so deeply embedded in the culture. You know, a lot of times we from the outside, we hear, oh, this is a dish that a lot of people of that country love. And we think, oh, you know, it's just an easy to say kind of thing or an easy to sell marketing thing. But the empanada really is deeply embedded, right?
Yes, it is.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Chile identifies with the empanada. Like, I think they say, you know, there's nothing more Chilean than empanadas and red wine. You know, empanadas y vino tinto. It's like, it's literally, you know, the Independence Day dish, the celebration dish, the you got a promotion at work dish, you know, Sunday and you don't know what to do with yourself, you go to the bakery and buy some empanadas. So it's kind of this, it's as much a go-to dish as it is something for special occasions.
And in your family, I would imagine I imagine Margarita being at the stove, frantically frying empanada after empanada, trying to fill up a plate, but the plate never gets full because everybody's grabbing them too fast.
You've just described most of our parties. I mean, they are for me. I mean, part of the reason I was interested in writing about them, too, is that they are. I've eaten a lot of empanadas. I've traveled all over South America. I've eaten them in Argentina. I've eaten them in Chile and Peru, all kinds of places. But what I really think makes my mom's empanadas a standout is this magical ratio of this very juicy, well-seasoned beef that, becomes hot through the frying process in this perfectly crisp yet still chewy dough. Like, it's this alchemy of flavors and textures that I remember when my husband tried them for the first time, he was like, these are the best empanadas I've ever had. And that's something he stands by to this day. Anytime we eat empanadas at a restaurant, he thinks they don't hold a candle to my mother's.
I'm surprised that anybody in your family would order empanadas at a restaurant.
Well, they do take 2 days to make, so sometimes out of expediency.
And they take 2 days. Why?
Well, it's not 2 full days, but you do have to make the filling the day before. And of course, now you have food processors and that, but I used to do this by hand, the chopping of the onions and all of that. So it takes a little bit of time. But the next day, I would say in order to make 50 empanadas, it will take me 2 or 3 hours to roll out the dough, and because you do it little by little.
And how many people will consume 50 empanadas?
Depends on the people. If there is mostly men, you'll probably not feed more than 8.
What a pleasure it has been to have the two of you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Carolina Miranda and her mother, Margarita Miranda. Carolina wrote a story about her mom's empanadas for Lucky Peach. We've got a link to her story and the recipe on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. You know, tis the season for fried foods. Hanukkah begins tomorrow, and we're celebrating with Japanese latkes. Stay with us.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Good Food. Pork schnitzel with tonkatsu sauce, masa ball ramen. They're at once familiar, but not quite. When chefs Sawa Okochi and Aaron Israel met, they immediately began cooking for each other. Over time, they married, literally, like each other. and they ended up marrying their culinary heritages too. The result is reflected on the menu at Shalom Japan, their restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Hi, Sawa.
Hi.
First, I have to ask you about the name, Shalom Japan. Where did it come from?
The name came from actually a restaurant that existed in the 80s in Soho. Aaron and I were in the library one day, and we were researching for our own project. He was researching for his own Jewish restaurant he wanted to do, and I was researching for my own supper club. And he pulled out this menu from a restaurant called Shalom Japan, and we got such a kick out of it. We were like, this could be the name of our restaurant if we ever do a restaurant together.
I love that, the synchronicity of just getting pushed together to do something that you were meant to do from the start.
Yeah, we didn't know that at the time, but, you know, it was really funny.
So I'm curious, how did this sort of mashup of Jewish and Japanese traditions on the plate or in a bowl, how did it start? Do you remember the first time one of you riffed on the other's tradition?
We went to a restaurant in the city for dinner, and it was like a Japanese food, and the last course was like a rice and salmon over it, and it was, the salmon was kind of overcooked, so we were kind of disappointed of the last course, and Aaron was like, I'm going to recreate it much better, and he did make it much better, and then we were talking about, oh, you know what, we can put lox on the rice. We tried it, and it was pretty delicious. So that was one of the things. We have it on the menu, sushi rice and lox over it, and some Japanese pickles and samuro.
I feel like these two cuisines were really meant to meet and share some time together. So Hanukkah starts tomorrow, and I understand that you have a tradition of okonomiyaki latkes, which is, I have to say, total genius. So could you describe the traditional way of making the pancake and then tell me how it became a latke?
Yeah, there is no traditional way to make okonomiyaki per se, I don't think, because okonomi means whatever you like. So you can, like, I mean, the basic thing is like a batter, like flour. Some people put rice flour. We do that. Some people do just water. Some people put eggs. We put the dashi for more flavor. And then we dump in the cabbage and onion and bean sprouts. And that's the pancake part.
But then it can get pretty Baroque on top.
Yeah, you could put anything you want. I mean, a lot of traditional way, it's usually like pork, like thin sliced pork belly. Those are popular ones. I grew up in Hiroshima, so Hiroshima style is like a little different than that. It's more like a more complicated sort of, it's like layers of pancake batter, nothing in it, just plain crepe butter, cabbage, bean sprouts, pork, noodle, egg, cheese if you want, bonito flakes and aonori. So I made it kind of simpler and just put everything in the batter, which is more popular way throughout Japan.
So do you do it a la trafe with the pork in it, or do you take the pork out for Hanukkah?
For Hanukkah, we do creme fraiche and salmon roe and little lemon juice and scallions.
But you serve it with pastrami, right?
And for regular, yeah, we do. So we do the cabbage onion batter, and we put the sauerkraut we make in the house and pastrami on top with okonomi sauce, scallion, bonito flakes, and aonori.
I love okonomi sauce. Could you describe it?
It's like really good Japanese barbecue sauce, you know? It's got like ketchup in it, it's kind of sweet, and it's got smoky from like Worcestershire sauce and a lot of like extract of fruits, I will say.
Yeah, it's so good. I love those pancakes. Well, it's wonderful talking to you. Thank you for sharing this
You're welcome.
Interesting tradition with us.
Yeah, no problem. Happy Hanukkah.
Same to you.
Thank you.
That was Sawa Okochi, along with her husband, Aaron Israel. She's the chef and co-owner of Shalom Japan in Brooklyn. We've got a recipe for her okonomiyaki latke on the Good Food blog. It's time for Jonathan Gold. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and a weekly fixture right here on Good Food. Today, we're off to Beru. It's an unassuming little spot tucked into a mini mall at the corner of Santa Monica and Wilton.
So you go into the restaurant and it's really bare. I don't mean like a little bit bare. It's really bare. And, you know, one wall's kind of a blackboard that the menu is written on in chalk, very carefully, not haphazardly. And on another wall by the open kitchen is shelves, these floor-to-ceiling shelves that are crowded with, you know, glass jars and with plastic deli containers and with plastic boxes. And in each of them, something is fermenting.
So it's like a fermentation lab.
It's very much like a fermentation lab. It reminded me a lot of not Noma, but the houseboat that is parked outside Noma. You know, so there's almost like a cordon sanitaire, so none of the weird experiments on the houseboat can actually get into the restaurant. But this is here, right in the restaurant.
One wonders how the health department even understands what's going on in there.
You know, every restaurateur that I've talked to about this has the exact same question, and they all really, really want to know.
Okay, so who are the people behind this?
The chef behind Beru is Kwang Ah, who I guess was born in Korea, and he cooked a few places, and he staged at sort of the high-end places. He was at Noma. He was at Piazza Duomo in Alba, which is known for its sort of strange experimentations on Italian food, and Quique da Costa near Valencia in Spain, which is also known for super experimental food. So we know where he's coming from.
So is he doing those kind of strange experimental food, or is he doing bowls with fermented stuff?
Both. I mean, it all falls under the rubric of what I tend to call things in a bowl. You know, there are grains, there are greens, there are herbs, there are squishy things, it all comes together. You know, one of his things is actually called a bibim salad, which is probably the first thing that, you know, most people order because it sounds like something you've heard of before at least. And it comes out and it's, you know, strange things with, you know, there's oats, there's quinoa, there's bulgur, there's fennel, there's asparagus, there's celery, there's radish, carrot, pumpkin, sunflower seeds, a big lump of what I assume is homemade gochujang, the Korean chili paste. There's canned Italian tomatoes from San Marzano and baby kale and I think slivered Asian pears. Also passion fruit powder, because how could you have a bibim salad without passion fruit powder?
So it's interesting because on one hand, you know, preservation and fermentation is such an old form of cooking. And yet so much of this seems that it's refracted through a very intellectual lens. So is the actual act of eating a pleasurable thing?
I don't know.
How can you not know? You ate there.
Well, it's fine. I like it. I liked it. I've taken friends there. They liked it. They would go again. I would go again. But it's that sort of strange thing, and you realize that it's the future because we're all going to be eating like this. But it's hard to know whether it's sort of this utopian future where we're all super healthy because of all these superfoods, and we're living a million years and we're in eternal sunshine and everything is great, or whether it's a dystopian future and we're all down in the caves to which we've been reduced, scraping mold off the wall because it's all that exists. It's one or the other, and this food fits both scenarios. So what I'd say is probably the signature dish there, and the dish that I would completely recommend that you get if you go, is called nuruk.
Nuruk.
Nuruk is a kind of mold. In other words, you're getting like a mold combo plate. It comes out. It's pink. It's creamy. It has like herbs and other things sprinkled on it. And it's a bunch of grains and seeds, some of which I knew about and some of which, like Jacob's Tears, I had never heard of.
So it's a mold combo plate that is incredibly delicious.
It's really good. And so you sit there and you sort of dig down, and it's a weird sort of pinky brown because I think they might do their culture with beets. And I thought there were beans in there for a while because it sort of reminded me a little of that sort of like nutty, funky taste of chongdrukchang, the, you know, the Korean fermented bean thing. But it wasn't that at all. And let me point out that Nuruk is a mold, but it's very close to koji, which is the mold that Japanese use to make and Chinese use to make, you know, soy sauce and miso. And
it's the mold.
Yeah, it's the mold. This is the Korean version. It's used to make makgeolli, the sort of chunky rice wine. You know, Nuruk and koji have this like sort of miraculous ability to ferment starches.
What about the beverages? Is it Kombucha City?
They have so many different kinds of kombucha. I myself do not partake of the booch. So every time I go there, I get the tepache, which is essentially the same thing, but it's fermented pineapple. And it at least has, you know, Mexican roots in, you know, Jalisco that I understand.
Wow. So interesting.
One of the funny things is there's something on the menu board that's pasta with ragu. And the ragu is supposed to contain faux oxtail. And it comes out and there's like, it's like a meat sauce. It's dense, it's rich. There's tomatoes. There's a white powder sprinkled over it. And there's this chip coming out. And the interesting thing is you have no idea what you're eating. I mean, if it's faux oxtail, does that mean it's like textured vegetable protein? Does that mean they discovered something new to do with a mushroom? Is it some gluten product? No, it's actually just some other kinds of beef that they've stewed together to, like, for example, oxtail. And the odd white powder is, in fact, extra aged Parmesan cheese.
So they're just blowing your mind on purpose.
They're kind of just blowing your mind on purpose. Where else are you going to get a plate of like pasta and tomato sauce and think it's something from outer space?
That's really funny. Well, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Beru in Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866 and you will get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. In a minute, what does Nordic cuisine mean? And how does chili cream chicken and banana casserole fit into it? Chef Magnus Nielsen explains. Next.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Nordic cuisine, what does that even mean? It's five countries and many islands, each with their own ingredients and traditions. And a new book aims to capture the entirety of it in 600 recipes. You may know the author, Chef Magnus Nielsen, from his restaurant, Faviken in Sweden. Our producer, Jillian Ferguson, spoke with him about his latest project, The Nordic Cookbook.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. So I just want to get a sense of this book to our listeners. I actually weighed it, and it's 5.5 pounds. It's a huge book. It was really intimidating to open, to be honest. So what inspired the project?
Well, actually, at first I didn't want to do it at all, and I was kind of offended by the idea of it because I didn't like that someone wanted to take all of the different food cultures of the Nordic region, putting them into one. and just kind of labeling that with something. Then I kind of realized that that was the reason why the book was necessary, you know, to actually explain how they differ from each other and how they tie together and also stuff like that.
So talk to me a little bit about the process of collecting these recipes. Who did you reach out to?
So it was a lot about traveling and like spending time in, you know, the different Nordic communities. And I thought I knew quite a lot about Nordic food culture before I started. And I kind of realized halfway or something that I knew almost nothing. So that was pretty fantastic.
So give me an example of something that surprised you.
I think like the most surprising thing was just to discover that there was so much variety and diversity. Like something like the meatball, which is, you'll find version of meatballs all across the Nordic region. And they're going to really mirror the place where they're made. So, for example, in Denmark, you're going to have a lot of pork and veal in the meatballs, which is predominantly what's farmed there. If you go to Sweden, a country that's huge for dairy production, there's a lot of beef in the meatballs. Like where I grew up, we hunt a lot of moose. So naturally, the meatballs are made from moose. You go to Greenland, they use seal. Essentially the same technique, the same idea, the concept of the dish, but then utilizing, you know, whatever's available locally.
Yeah, learning about Greenland was so interesting. I mean, if people have watched Mind of a Chef, they've seen you go to the Faroe Islands, which is equally fascinating and a really singular culture. But the culture of eating seal, does that exist anywhere else in the Nordic countries?
People have been eating seal pretty much everywhere where seal exists historically, all across the world. Today in the Nordics, it's very rare. I've only come across it basically on Greenland. And the most fascinating thing with the seal is that the Inuit culture, the sort of indigenous people to Greenland, they almost subsisted entirely on seal. And the woman that helped me out with the sort of local expertise on Greenland, she explained that it was simply because the seal is always there. Like, there are other meats available. You know, they hunt for narwhal, for example. But it's seasonal because they migrate. So they're there for a bit and then they leave. The seal is always there. It's always handy. And it can be used to so many things. You know, they make clothing from the fur. They produce fuel from the blubber and eat the meat and so on.
I'd love to talk about sandwiches because a couple times in the book, you mentioned the importance of sandwiches to the Nordic region. And also there's an essay in the book that goes pretty deeply into the differences between bread and toppings and even the fat that's used to lubricate the sandwich. So maybe pick two countries and compare the differences in those sandwiches.
So the sandwich is actually, it's a really interesting cultural marker because it says so much about the place where it's consumed. If you compare Denmark, for example, which have, you know, they have a fantastic open sandwich culture, and you compare that to like northern Sweden. So if you start to look at Denmark as a country, it's the gateway for trade between the Nordics and Central Europe in a historical perspective, simply because it has a land connection. And it's also a very rich agricultural region, a lot of farmlands and rich soils and good growing climate and stuff like that. So naturally you have like great variety and also a lot of people with the financial means to eat well and eat a lot. Because that shows on the sandwiches, you know, they're often completely fully laden. You can't pick them up and eat them from your hand. You have to eat them on a plate with a fork and knife. And it's a kind of a whole meal in itself. If you go up further north to where I come from, historically quite a poor region, harsher climate, you know, small holdings, small farms. A sandwich would be more something like a piece of dry crisp bread, flat bread, with a layer of butter and a slice of cheese on it. Really reflecting, you know, that region. And it would never be something you would have eating with a fork and knife. It would be something that you ate standing up, basically.
So speaking of your region, I had the pleasure of going to your restaurant about a year ago, and I noticed that one of the dishes that I had at Favikin is represented in the book, although in a much simpler version. It's the blood bread that's been cooked and then dried. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so like in the old days, people really only slaughtered animals in the autumn, you know, when they were nice and fat after a summer on lush grass and stuff like that. And in order to be able to eat and profit from the meat over a longer period of time, it was necessary to preserve it. And like lots of it was salted and turned into charcuterie and stuff like that. But the blood, which is very perishable, was often used to bake bread. So you know, you added the pig's blood or beef blood instead of water in a bread dough, for example. And by doing that, by baking in bread with blood and then drying the bread, you can keep it for a really long time, and you can just soak it in broth or water and poach it or boil it when it's time to eat it.
There's a recipe in the book that I have to ask you about because I'm a child of the 80s, so I can kind of sympathize. Chili creamed chicken and banana casserole. This is not something I expected to find in the Nordic cookbook. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so there was a lot of debate on which kinds of recipes to be included. And to me, it was very important that this book didn't turn into kind of some romanticized fairy tale version of Nordic food culture, but actually says what people eat today. And I think that one is a really good example of that. It's a dish that I had growing up, and it's a dish that's widely consumed in Sweden, much more commonly consumed probably than, like, for example, the sour herring.
So describe it for us.
So it's basically it's a casserole. It's like an oven dish, and you usually you buy a grilled chicken. And you season it with like an Italian salad seasoning, like a seasoning mix used for salad dressing normally. And then you top that with the cream and Heinz chili sauce and bananas and peanuts.
Like fresh bananas.
Yeah. And then you serve it with white rice. Maybe some iceberg salad on the side. It's disturbingly delicious.
Really? Oh, great. Yep. Well, Magnus, thank you so much. The book is beautiful, and I can't wait to try that banana casserole.
Please do.
That was Chef Magnus Nielsen talking to Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson. His latest book is The Nordic Cookbook. And yes, Jillian did make that chili creamed chicken banana casserole. Is it actually delicious? Find out. We've got the recipe with photos on the Good Food blog. Wherever there is wealth, there's a desire for luxury. And the promise of status, well, it's a powerful tool. The story of how wine entered China is almost a handbook for the newly rich, where often potential for profit matters more than connoisseurship. Tycoons with corkscrews in hand from Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong are willing and able to pay top dollar, and the global wine market will never be the same. Suzanne Mustasich is a contributing editor at Wine Spectator. Her book is Thirsty Dragon, China's Lust for Bordeaux and the Threat to the World's Best Wines. And what a book this is, Suzanne. So fascinating.
Thank you.
Begin by explaining this whole system of first growth estates of Bordeaux and the 1855 classification, because that matters quite a bit in your story.
Yeah, it does. In 1855, there was a World's Fair in Paris, and Bordeaux ended up presenting some wines, mainly because Burgundy and Champagne were going to present wines. So they needed some way to present them to the world to make sense of it, to explain what they were showing. And the brokers had the list of prices for the wines from decades. And that's how they had their own internal ranking of these wines. And so that was the birth of the 1855 classification. It was just a way to make sense of the wines to the public who was going to come see these wines. And it ended up becoming institutionalized in Bordeaux, a way to market Bordeaux's wines. It was never meant to be a permanent ranking, but it did end up becoming a permanent ranking. There's only been two changes since then.
And so what is the story of Bordeaux in China? Why did Bordeaux end up being so important in the Chinese market, and who first introduced it?
Well, it's actually a really fascinating story, because Bordeaux, especially we have a lot of discussions about globalization today, but Bordeaux has always been an export product for hundreds of years. Bordeaux's merchants have been trying to sell wine in China since the late 1700s. So their job, unlike the wine growers, is to find new markets. And those markets are always difficult, precarious, often very unlikely. They succeeded in the 1800s getting it into the treaty ports, to the expat community in China. And then after the Communist Revolution, everything dried up. When China opened up, wine was right there in 78 and 79. When China opened up to joint ventures, the second joint venture was a French wine company, and it still exists today, Dynasty. At the same time, there were hotels, five-star hotels for expats. Remember, Chinese, the annual income, average income was about $180. So there was no domestic demand for wine. There was no thought that there was going to be anytime soon a domestic demand for wine. But there were expats, and there were Chinese officials needing to entertain those expats and those investors. So Bordeaux has a great way of going in with their first gross or second gross, their classified gross. There's five classified gross total, and saying these represent the very best of wine in the world. They represent history, luxury, quality. It's sort of the perfect way for the Chinese to host Western dinners or dinners for Westerners. It was a no-fault gift, okay? Everyone was going to be impressed. At the same time, the expats love seeing these wines on the wine list. So the first person to get the wine really into New China was Thomas Yip from Hong Kong.
And does the Yip family still maintain a big hold on wine imports into China?
Oh, absolutely. They're one of the key players, really, in developing the Chinese market. But they worked at it for years and years and years until now, of course, they have a very large stake in the market in Hong Kong and in mainland China. They've been instrumental in developing the market for these wines. But remember, the China opened up to wine. It wasn't just opening up to Bordeaux wine. Bordeaux was there to say, this is this great product. It's sophisticated. There's a seal of approval, sort of, that goes with these wines. But at the same time, China was opening up to wine. They themselves needed to move people away from consuming grain-based alcohol because they need the grain to feed people. At the same time, they're looking for foreign investment. And there you have the second joint venture is a wine company. That sends a signal that this could be a very good thing for China. Of course, they're also thinking long-term that this could eventually be an export product. So you're creating jobs. These are all very attractive to the Chinese government.
So I'm really fascinated by this moment in time where the palates are being trained or retrained to accept this new beverage that they had no real frame of reference for. So when it first gained popularity in China, was it mixed with something to make the tannins more palatable?
Initially, the wine that they were drinking probably would have been even been domestic wine. And it was most likely very, very poor in quality. It still is often very poor in quality. It's not always grape-based. It's sometimes got, it's got colorants. It's got, you know, aromas added. It's got all sorts of chemicals added to it. So it's not a very good ambassador for wine, let's put it that way, with the Chinese population. To introduce it really to the Chinese palate, they did mix it with soft drinks, but you know, we have wine coolers in America. How different is that? They had to start developing their own palate for wine, and they're still doing that. It's not because that a certain type of wine is enjoyed in France or in California that the Chinese are gonna like it. At first they're drinking wine because they're told to drink wine, not because they like it. In 1996, Li Peng during the People's Congress, toasted with red wine. That made it the official drink. This was supposed to be good for your health. This was good for China to drink red wine. You didn't have to like it. You were just supposed to drink it. And it made it a great gift. So this made red wine suddenly extremely popular.
So how much does Bordeaux depend on China as a market now?
It's enormous. When Bordeaux was first trying to export wine to China. So when China was opening up, they were selling fewer than 4,000 bottles to China. Today, they ship 55 million. And at the height of the speculative market, it was between 71 and 72 million bottles. China really started buying Bordeaux during the economic crisis, during the banking crisis, when the American market was crumbling, as well as European markets were completely hamstrung. People didn't have banks. Restaurants were closing. Hotels were struggling to pay their wine bills as well. There just wasn't any orders. And so that was when the Chinese speculators first really entered the Bordeaux market. The people who bought that vintage, the 2008 vintage in 2009, bought it at a very relatively low price, about roughly around 100 a bottle, between 95 and 110 a bottle. And those people made an enormous profit very quickly. And word got out that you could make a lot of money buying Bordeaux, especially Bordeaux classified gross.
You talk about how often in bulk wine in China, there are a lot of adulterants, colorants, different kind of chemicals, aromas, things added. Is counterfeiting an increasing issue, or is, as the market becomes more educated, is counterfeiting becoming less of an issue?
Counterfeiting is an enormous issue. It's a massive issue, and it's not going away. There is a French report by the French Trade Commission on counterfeiting in China, and they found that for every real bottle of French wine, there was at least one fake bottle of French wine. Now, the counterfeiters, they don't stop counterfeiting because you've attacked them in court. They might just move on to a different wine. Okay, they're not going to get a new job. They're not going to look for a new career plan. They counterfeit, and they counterfeit wine. And it's at an industrial level. It's not just the chicken farm, abandoned chicken farm with a small bottling line. Those are those stories that are interesting to write about in news stories. But the real problem comes from a very well-organized business industry in counterfeiting wine. And it's extremely active. They fake Chinese brands as well. It's not just imported wine that's targeted by the counterfeiters. And for the Chinese consumer, it's terrible. There's certainly cases of them, the counterfeiters adding nasty chemicals. And that's the only point when the Chinese government really gets involved and cracks down. They're worried about food poisoning, of course. But if it's just, if they're just counterfeiting and taking Chilean bulk and putting Bordeaux on the label, the government's not too concerned about that. But again, this happens to Chinese wines. I was talking to a Chinese winemaker in the middle of the country who explained to me that they can sell 50 cases to their sub-distributor who sells another 100 because they're faking it. And they can complain to the police, but they have to pay the police to investigate, and nothing happens. You know, the person's maybe shut down for a day or pays a fine, and they just continue on because they're paying the police as well. So it's not just, it's counterfeiting, but it's also corruption.
Suzanne, what a fascinating book you've written. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Suzanne Mustasich. Her book is Thirsty Dragon, China's Lust for Bordeaux and the Threat to the World's Best Wines. More liquid intelligence coming up. It's the politics of big soda. Next.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Soda and cigarettes. What do they have in common? Well, good food advocates believe that big food targets the same young and vulnerable audience as tobacco companies did for decades. Marion Nessel is one of the most powerful advocates in the fight for good food in the U.S., the respected professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University challenged big food with her seminal work, Food Politics. With her latest book, Soda Politics, she lays out a framework to advocate for the health of upcoming generations. Hi, Marion.
Hi.
So I guess we should start by defining soda. From a nutritionist's standpoint, what is it?
Well, it's water, carbonated water usually, flavoring, acidification agents, and sugars. Lots and lots of sugars.
And how much sugar do we consume in this country in the form of soda?
Well, sodas account for a third of total sugar intake. And if you count all sugar-sweetened beverages, teas, flavored milks, and so forth, it's half.
Wow, half. So demographically, who drinks the most soda?
Well, the industry is very clear about that, and it publishes all these data on it. But so does track with cigarettes. The same people who smoke cigarettes are the ones who drink sodas, and they tend to be young, male, working class, not very well educated, and not having very much money. But because that's the demographic, and I should say that minorities are the other big demographic who are soda drinkers, much of the marketing is targeted to young males and to people in minority groups because that's where the sales are.
How important is it to get the customer when they are young?
Well, the soda companies think that if they can get people when they're young, then they will have brand loyalty to that particular brand forever. And the branding issue is very important because if you do taste tests, blind taste tests between Coke and Pepsi, for example, nobody can tell the difference. People think they can, but they're guessing and it'll be a matter of chance. But people have passionate feelings about which one they like better. That's the brand part.
And does it go beyond brand to the urge to drink it at all?
Well, if you're advertising, you know, that you should have this delicious cold drink, and people do love the taste of these things, then that's going to make you want to drink. I went to Coca-Cola World in Atlanta not too long ago and was just amazed to watch all the commercials, which don't really talk about sodas very much. They just mark moments of intense emotion in people's lives that are celebrated with, in that case, Coca-Cola. You're not even thinking about it. You're not supposed to be thinking about it. You're supposed to just feel it.
How much soda is sold annually?
Oh, there are billions of cans every day and trillions annually throughout the world. I mean, the numbers are so enormous, I can't add up the number of zeros. It's an astonishing amount. In the United States alone, the average consumption is something like 30 gallons a year per person, and that means men, women, and little tiny children, and that's just of the sweetened variety. So the average intake is 1 12-ounce soda a day for every man, woman, and child in the country. Half the people in the country don't drink sodas at all. That means everybody else is drinking a minimum of two.
I've noticed that some of the marketing that we see here in Southern California on billboards seems to be veering away from pure happiness to a sort of tempered, more moderate message. Have we begun to drink less soda? Are they worried?
I would say frantic. Soda sales started to decline in the United States in the late 1990s, but there's been somewhere between a 10 to 15 year decline in soda consumption. The soda industry attributes this to health advocacy to prevent obesity, and that's what they report to the Securities and Exchange Commission every year, and have reported that for the last 10 years at least, 12 years at least.
So let's talk about health advocacy and just sort of this strange link or de-link between soda consumption and health. Last week, Rona S. Applebaum, Coke's chief science and health officer, a bizarre title, stepped down. What was her role in Coca-Cola, and why is her departure so important? What does it tell us?
Well, it's the result of a scandal. And the scandal was that Coca-Cola was discovered to be funding something called the Global Energy Balance Network, which came out of the University of Colorado. And its job was to say that it doesn't matter what you eat or drink, it's physical activity that makes the difference in obesity prevention, and you don't really have to worry about cutting down on what you eat or drink, especially of sugary sodas. And Coca-Cola was found out to be funding that to the tune of millions of dollars. When that was revealed in the New York Times, people were shocked. I mean, I talked to a lot of reporters, and they had no idea. My book hadn't come out yet. If it had, they would have read the chapters in the book, and they would have known all that, because I certainly did. But the fallout from that has been amazing. It was a public relations scandal for Coca-Cola. They dealt with it by going transparent and publishing the list of all of the organizations that they fund on their website. The result of that has been that the leading health organizations that they were funding have severed their ties with Coca-Cola. The University of Colorado School of Medicine has given a $1 million Coca-Cola grant back to Coca-Cola. The Associated Press did an investigation and got emails that showed that Coca-Cola was intimately involved in developing, conducting, and interpreting the research that came out of that program. And as a result of that, Rona Applebaum resigned. And now the Global Energy Balance Network just announced that it was closing because it doesn't have any money.
Wow. Well, Marian, thank you for all the work that you've done to really teach us in great detail about all of this stuff.
Well, thank you.
That was Marian Nessel, respected professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. Her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We've heard a lot on climate change this week as world leaders gathered in Paris for the UN Climate Change Conference. But to know how warmer weather and ongoing drought are affecting us closer to home, all you have to do is look at your local farmer's market. This week, Laura Avery catches up with farmers and fishermen who are facing new challenges in the fields and on the boat.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Some of the farmers have been starting to tell me that they are going to be having to take some time off from the farmers market because they literally don't have any crops in their field. And I think this is the culmination of the whole drought cycle that we're experiencing now. And Barbara Wyman, who's been working with Tutti Frutti Farms for many, many years, I just got the word from Barbara that they will be taking off from early December all the way probably through April. And Barbara, tell us what's going on the farm that's made this happen.
Well, initially, it's that the bugs, our winter crops, because we planted the winter crops, which we usually have the different colors of kale and carrots and broccoli, cauliflower and leeks and, you know, all the winter crops that we usually have. But the Bodega bug and a few other bugs, because it's been just a really bad year on bugs since we've had 3 years of not having a real winter, which slows them, you know, they go dormant, they die, they get drowned with the rain. So for 3 years, that hasn't happened, and they just keep reproducing, and they reproduce quick. Plus, we have bugs that we've never seen before because of the weather changes. You know, bugs are coming in who normally would not be in our area.
Yeah, now I've seen those Bagrata bugs. They're like little shield beetle kind of looking things. When you say there's new bugs, are these bugs you can even see?
Yeah, you mean other than those? Because those are new. They've only been here for about 3 years. They're a South African bug. And they started, you know, they came over a few years ago and started, from what I understand, in Southern California and has worked their way up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the warm weather didn't interrupt their life cycle and the rain didn't flood them out. And so now we just have just a ton of bugs.
Yeah, because they can just keep reproducing and they're not killed off.
Yeah. All right, well then Chris is going to take some time off. Of course, his spot will be here when he's ready to come back. And I think this is a story we're going to be hearing from more and more farmers this winter.
Yeah. You know, every farmer's having a problem with the drought. And I know there's some farmers that are just out because of the lack of water, too.
Mm-hmm. All right, Barbara. Well, thank you so much. And Tutti Frutti Farms, and we're going to stay tuned and keep everybody posted. Thanks a lot. That was Barbara Wyman. She has been a longtime employee here at Tutti Frutti Farms, and this is the first year that any of us can remember that they will be taking several months off because of weather conditions related to the drought. One of the other areas that's being affected by climate change is the oceans. And we are talking with Ben Hyman, who is the owner and head fisherman of Wild Local Seafood. He and his folks bring in many, many varieties of sustainably caught California coastal seafood to the market. And Ben, you are such an advocate for sustainability. This is all you ever talk about. Tell us what you're noticing out there in the California coastal waters about the species of fish and what varieties you're finding.
Well, it's definitely apparent that this is an El Nino year through the species that the vessel are catching. Definitely it's the most or the highest sea surface temperatures I've seen in the last 19 years commercial fishing. For instance, California king salmon, which I typically target from May, June, July, August into September, we found a lack of the fish being in California waters at the end of June. So for the first time in 15 years, we flipped everything over and we started to fish for yellowfin tuna, which was doing kind of the opposite of the salmon. So as one was going to another area, the tuna were taking the salmon's place. Bluefin tuna were caught in places like Monterey Bay. You'll see species like sea turtles in the San Joaquin River, as well yellow-bellied sea snakes were found in the Ventura area. And these are species that usually are far below San Diego, way down in warm waters, making their way all the way up into the California coast.
Is there actually a way, or is there one agency that can regulate California coastal waters?
You know, there are conflicting agencies, but I think pretty much everyone's on board. Things like with the Domoic crab issues going on with the algal bloom, we have a really, you know, warm sea surface temperature and a warm ocean that's caused this red algal bloom. The Dungeness crab industry is a $60 million a year industry, and it's impacted. But I hope it raises an eyebrow to everyone as far as how warm our ocean is and how our conditions are changing, and there are consequences to this change.
So there will be no Dungeness crab available this year, for, as we know right now?
Well, not at my booth. Other businesses are still supporting fishermen in Washington and even into southern Oregon and doing things like keeping the price set high there, where they're really going out on a limb and paying fishermen high in these areas right now to keep the stock of crab coming here. In the meantime, the fishermen friends that I have put, you know, from tens to 20s to 30s to 50 thousands of dollars, large sums of money into their gear, the repair of their crab gear in preparation for the season. And they're all sitting nervously waiting for the go to go fish. And at the same time, a large consumer base is nervously waiting to eat crab.
So Ben, looking forward, you fish all year round, so we will just come check in with you and see what you're catching, and if it's in season or, you know, a different season than usual, you will just be here to tell us what's going on.
As long as there's an ocean, I'll be here.
Okay. Thanks, Ben. That was Ben Hyman, and he is a highly sustainable, committed, dedicated fisherman. He sells at the Santa Monica Wednesday, the Pico Saturday Santa Monica, and the Sunday Mar Vista Farmers Markets with fresh-caught California sustainable coastal fish. He's someone to visit, and certainly you will not get away without having a conversation with Ben. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Camelia, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.